You know, sometimes what happens in here is like taking a shit.
Yes, okay. Although I prefer to think of it more like childbirth.
Trust me, it's like taking a shit.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat! You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 281 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com and Stitcher Radio here for Sunday, June 30th, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. We have got a loaded show this week. We're going to talk ROH, Raw, NXT, some TNA news, do the mailbag, and we're going to be debuting a new segment at the end of the show this week in wrestling history. So a lot of stuff to go over this week, but we have to lead off with the unfortunate news, the death of Matt Osborne, better known to most people as the original Doink the Clown in WWF. Also, Maniac Matt Bourne, Big Josh during his WCW days. He wrestled all over the place. He bounced around to a lot of different places, spent some time in WWF in the mid-80s. He was actually at the first WrestleMania on the original card, losing to Ricky Steamboat. Went away for a while, came back in 1993, and got the big push as Doink the Evil Clown, which was the best incarnation of the Doink character that they ever had, was that original heel character. You go back and look at it now. I mean, yes, he's dressed as a clown, wearing clown makeup and a big red nose and the green wig and all that. But there was a lot of creativity in the character. And as a heel, Doink was awesome. You know, he would pop kids' balloons and make them cry. And he was a great wrestler. That was what I really loved about the character was he didn't just come out dressed up as a clown, which, you know, back in the day, the WWF had a lot of characters that people would probably look at as being too cartoony, and Doink certainly fit that mold, but Doink was a great wrestler. You know, he would go in there. He had some great matches on Raw with, you know, guys like Marty Jannetty. He had great matches with Mr. Perfect. Even the match he had at SummerSlam back in 93 with Bret Hart was actually a very, very good match. So he can go in the ring and back it up, and Bobby Heenan had this gimmick going on commentary where he would pretend like he knew this guy from somewhere, but he couldn't quite place where he knew him from. He goes, I think I know who this guy is, but I can't quite put my finger on it, but he's a great wrestler, and they would put over his wrestling skills. So I really like the original Doink character. Once they turned the character babyface later in the year into 94, pretty much went to hell, and he wasn't even portraying the character at that point. A lot of people may not realize that Osborne only played the Doink character for 1993. I think it was right around Survivor Series time, or so, maybe even just before that. When he left the company, he had some, I want to say, drug issues, whatever the issues were. He got booted. They brought in some other wrestler named Ray Apollo to play the role. A lot of people have played Doink over the years. Steve Kern, who up until recently ran developmental. Steve Lombardi, better known as the Brooklyn Brawler. I think he portrayed Doink quite a bit over the years when they would bring the character back for appearances here and there. So it was a fairly short run, if you think about it, for Osborne. But he played Doink better than anybody else, and it's a shame. You know, 56, I believe he would have been next month, and I guess his girlfriend found him unresponsive in their home, in his home down in Texas. Don't know yet the cause of death, but interestingly enough, on Twitter, Sean Waltman, upon learning the news, posted a tweet that said, "Just heard about Matt Bourne, another one gone. Was in WWE-sponsored facility with him, that being rehab. Saw him after we were both out, sad but not surprised." And he went on to post a few more tweets. He obviously knows more than I do and a lot of us do as far as the kind of stuff that, you know, Osborne may have been into in recent years. Doesn't sound very good. He's had his demons and problems and has done a lot of bad shit. And one thing I was not aware of in reading some bios about him, and there's not a lot of information about this, but apparently this would have been probably in the late 70s. I think he was in the Georgia territory and either had just started or was about to start a tag team with Arn Anderson. And who knows how far the two of them would have gone. He had to leave the area because of some, I believe it was sex assault allegations that were levied against him. And he had to get the hell out of town. So doesn't exactly sound like this guy was an angel. But as a performer, I thought he was very good. I will always look back on that first Doink character as the best of the bunch. You know, again, when they started bringing in Dink and they did the Survivor Series match against Lawler with the midgets Queasy and Cheesy and Sneezy and Breezy or whatever the hell their names were, it was a joke. And, I mean, he's a clown, so I guess it kind of fits, but that original portrayal of Doink, in my opinion, very underrated. I see people online saying, oh, you know, Hall of Fame, WWE Hall of Fame, and yeah, it's a shame, because I feel like whenever a wrestler dies from now on, if they had any bit, any shred of notoriety, you're going to get this swell of support for them in the Hall of Fame. Personally, I don't look at you know, the Doink character as a WWE Hall of Fame worthy character. I mean, some people do, and more power to them. I don't see it, but nonetheless, a shame that the guy is gone, and hopefully we will find out soon enough exactly what the cause is. I want to switch gears to Ring of Honor, talk about them a little bit. They've been in the news quite a bit over the last week, since last week's show, and after the issues with their Best in the World iPay-per-view last weekend, yes, more problems with an ROH iPay-per-view. I guess they're not the best in the world in terms of iPay-per-view. Ring of Honor has made the decision to discontinue all of their live iPay-per-view airings going forward and will instead post them online the day after each event. So basically, instead of fixing the problem, they just said, we give up. It's essentially what happened here. You know, if they don't want to spend the money to provide a stable connection for their streams, then yes, probably for the better to just stop doing it. It's beyond embarrassing at this point. It's funny, I never hear of people having these kind of problems whenever they order New Japan iPay-per-view shows on Ustream. I ordered one many months ago. I actually ordered a New Japan iPay-per-view. This probably was after it aired, because I heard nothing but raves about it, and I think it was something like $30 or something like that. And it worked great, and the show was fantastic, but the stream worked perfectly fine. You know, this foreign company doing iPay-per-view, and I'm sitting here in New York ordering the event, and I'm sure at the time that I ordered it, obviously there probably wasn't a whole lot of traffic because I didn't see the show live, but point is, the stream worked fantastically. Other indie promotions that are not owned by a multi-million dollar company like Sinclair Broadcasting, they run iPay-per-views just fine. Very rarely do I read about other people having issues the way they do with ROH, so what's their secret? Yeah, I'm sure ROH gets more orders than your standard indie that does iPay-per-view, but you can't tell me that they've got 10,000 people trying to order their show at one time. I mean, the numbers are not that high. I don't see that as a valid excuse. You know, my brother ordered the show, the ROH show, and he was more angry about the fact that they never bothered to post any sort of update on what the hell was going on. They just left people in the dark, which they've done before. You know, you'd think they would learn their lesson after the first time, but apparently not. They made this announcement about discontinuing their events a few days later. So why the radio silence for so long, I don't know. But, you know, even still, no acknowledgement about what happened, what went wrong, what the glitch was. You'd think almost that Gabe Sapolsky has a voodoo doll, you know, made up with an ROH logo on it, and every time they try to put on one of these pay-per-views, he stabs at it repeatedly. So, you know, good luck to them. I don't know how many people you're going to get to pay money for these shows a day later, on a weekday no less. I'm sure it'll hurt their numbers, but truth be told, they were probably doing more harm to their numbers with the crappy feeds, so hopefully this at least takes care of that problem. The other big news on the ROH front is that their reigning world champion Jay Briscoe and his brother Mark have both wrestled their final matches for Ring of Honor for the time being, maybe for good, nobody seems to know for sure. Their contracts have expired. ROH, at their recent TV tapings, ran an angle where Jay Briscoe was beat up by Scum, their heel faction, which apparently now is no more, fracturing his shoulder. Mark Briscoe suffered what they, I think, call severe head trauma. And so both men, written out of storylines in the event that they don't return, which they very well might if nobody else comes along with a better offer. The brothers had just wrestled each other in the main event of that iPay-per-view last weekend. Jay retained the championship. And apparently the hiatus had been known about for some time. So, you know, even if they think there's a good chance they'll just take a month or two off and re-sign with the company, why not get the title off the guy? You know, let him challenge for it when he comes back, if he comes back. Put the title on Matt Hardy in the meantime. I mean, that guy is probably the most hated man in the entire promotion right now. I was at the ROH show in New York City over WrestleMania weekend. He gets incredible heat from those people. They hate his guts with every fiber of their being. He's the Vicky Guerrero of Ring of Honor, only slightly less annoying. So what's the harm in putting the title on him for a month or two, and then if Briscoe comes back, he beats Hardy and gets the championship back? It just strikes me as being incredibly stupid if this guy is not under contract, even if you think he might come back. He's your world champion, and you knew this in advance. You had, at least for a few weeks, apparently they may have known for a few months that this was going to happen. Why the hell wouldn't you take the title off him? It just doesn't make any sense to me. There were reports at one point, a couple months back, that there was an offer made by WWE to the Briscoes, or at least they expressed an interest in the two of them, but there is no such deal on the table right now. Whether there's still interest in them, who knows? You know, I'm guessing not, after that whole Twitter fiasco back in May with Jay, you know, threatening to shoot anybody who tried to teach his kids that gay marriage was okay. I don't think that would fly too well with WWE, nor should it. But what happens to the ROH title in the meantime, nobody knows. They have yet to make any sort of official announcement, but they did say that Michael Elgin is next in line for a shot. That dude is a beast. The match I saw last year with him and Davey Richards when Davey was still the champion was incredible. Easily one of the matches of the year. And the match that he had with Jay Lethal at the Supercard of Honor show, the one that I went to over Mania weekend, that also was a great match. You know, the guy is good. He's real good. So I think ROH is in good hands in that respect if the plan is to at some point put the title on him. Monday Night Raw this past week was in North Charleston, South Carolina, hopefully for the final time, because the crowd in North Charleston, South Carolina on this night sucked. Boy, did this crowd suck. And it wasn't a bad show. You know, sometimes if the crowd is not lively, you could say, well, it's not their fault, they got a crappy show. That wasn't the case this week. This was actually a good show. I enjoyed Raw. And for whatever reason, they had their moments, but the crowd just wasn't into this show, and it reflected, unfortunately. It brought the show down a little bit. We'll do the good, the bad, and the ugly here. The good on this show, Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan had a street fight in the main event. They had a match on Raw last week. Bryan suffered the stinger. He was supposed to win that match. They went to a finish. Orton won. They did a rematch on SmackDown that went to a countout victory for Bryan, which he was not happy with. So this was the rubber match between the two of them, and this was going to be the match where Bryan got that big win he did not get the week before. And in the end, things probably worked out for the better. And I say that just because last week when they did Orton and Bryan, I think the match was in the first hour of the show, maybe it was the second, but it was somewhere early on, maybe in the middle portion of the show. And this week, they got the main event. They were the feature bout. They opened the show. They were going to do the match. They brawled. They announced the match would take place later. The fans would get to pick the stipulation. They picked street fight. And these two guys got to close out the show, which they would not have done the week before. So in that respect, maybe it was a good thing. The match itself was very good. There was early on in the match, a chair shot to the head. Bryan was going for a tope through the ropes. Orton was outside the ring. And Orton nailed him with a chair as Bryan hit the ropes, and WWE posted an item on their website on Friday. Now, why they waited until Friday when this happened on Monday, I have no idea, but they posted a story on their website announcing that both Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton were each fined an undisclosed amount for chair strikes to the head. Supposedly, there was another chair shot to the head later on. I didn't see it that way. There was a spot in the match, I think, where Bryan threw a chair at Orton as he came in, but he threw it at him. It didn't hit him in the head. I think it hit him in the shoulder. But I guess they claimed that was a chair shot to the head. So they both got fined an undisclosed amount. In the article, it said, though not disclosed, the heft of the fine was evident in Orton's reaction when Randy said, "Trust me, it was enough." I don't get what the big secret is. Why not just announce how much the fine was? Is there some reason for the secrecy here? I mean, I know, they don't have to announce it, but I don't understand why they would keep it such a secret. Why does it have to be undisclosed? I don't see what the big deal is. So, as for the match itself, Randy Orton tapped out to Daniel Bryan for the finish. Bryan used a no-lock. There was a lot of plunder. I mentioned the chairs. Kendo sticks were brought into the match. And these guys were whipping the crap out of each other with the kendo sticks. I'm sure that doesn't feel too good. So they both took a beating in this match. And it was a clever finish. You know, he had Orton in the no lock. Orton wouldn't tap. Orton was reaching for the cane that was laying on the mat. And when he grabbed it, Brian grabbed hold of it as well. And he basically pressed it up against Orton's face for added leverage. And Orton had no choice but to tap out. And there you go. A clean submission win for Daniel Bryan. There was, after the match, a handshake. Orton extended his hand. That's how you put somebody over. The way that they did it here with Randy Orton, that's how you put a new, you know, a quote new guy. He's new to the main event. A new guy over. And they even got the crowd into it by the end, which, again, is no easy task considering how crappy this crowd was. But this was the planned finish from last week. And my question is this. Can you envision John Cena tapping out to Daniel Bryan's finish the way that Randy Orton did this week? I'm sure Cena will do whatever's asked of him, but I guess the question should be, can you imagine WWE booking John Cena to tap out to Daniel Bryan's finish? In my wildest dreams, I cannot imagine a scenario. Has John Cena ever tapped out as a babyface? I don't believe he has. And neither did Hogan back in his heyday. I think I've mentioned that before. The only time I can ever remember Hulk Hogan as a babyface in WWF tapping out for a submission loss was against Kurt Angle in 2002. But Hogan, you know, when he came back in 2002, Hogan was losing to everybody. You know, he lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. He lost to Undertaker when he lost the championship. The next month he lost to Kurt Angle when he tapped out. He lost to Brock on television, so He was doing the honors for a lot of people back then, but it's a rare thing. It's not limited just to John Cena, but I'm just trying to play out these scenarios in my head when they have their match. Let's say if it happens at SummerSlam, I cannot envision a scenario where John Cena taps out to Daniel Bryan, which would be the ultimate way to put this guy over. I just can't see them doing it. I thought the CM Punk Paul Heyman segment in the ring was really good, if not a bit too long. Not fantastic like the Mark Henry swerve the week before, but still very good. They did start to repeat themselves a bit too much towards the end. The crowd was getting very restless. They were starting to chant, "We want wrestling," at one point. But, you know, these two guys are the two best talkers in the company. You put any other two guys in the segment and it would drag, but it never dragged for me, I will say that. You know, they were drawing on some real history in OVW when Punk first came in and Heyman was really his only defender. There were people in the company who wanted Punk gone, or they didn't think he'd ever be called up to the main roster. And Punk, or Heyman, I should say, he went to bat for CM Punk. He saw money in CM Punk. So they were shooting, I guess, in that respect. They were mixing it in with the storyline, so I kind of like that. And Punk talked about why he considers Paul Heyman a true friend, even though he recognizes that Paul Heyman is a lying, conniving, deceitful little cockroach. It's my word, not his. And, you know, why he can challenge Brock Lesnar while at the same time maintaining that friendship with Paul Heyman. So I appreciate that. I appreciate them going out of the way to explain things in a way that makes sense. Even though Punk is going to want a match with Brock, he can still be friends with Paul Heyman. So I like the fact that they explained that. I'm sure, you know, in the end, even though Heyman denied it on this show, I'm positive that we're going to learn that Heyman absolutely had something to do with Lesnar attacking Punk last week. You know, yeah, he swore on his children that he didn't, but he's a scumbag. Of course he would swear on his children. Heyman said the moment that Punk said Brock Lesnar needed his help, as in Paul's help, he picked a fight with Brock. So I like the way that they explained things here. It made sense, which is really all you can ask for. Alberto Del Rio, Chris Jericho had a match. Good match, marred by a silent audience. You would think it was an empty arena match at one point. Clever finish. They had Del Rio locking Jericho in the arm breaker. Jericho was using his feet to try to push off the ropes and flip himself over before putting Del Rio in the walls of Jericho. And that's when Ricardo Rodriguez nailed Jericho with the bucket from behind for the DQ. And Dolph Ziggler ran down. He attacked Del Rio, nailed him with the zigzag. Jericho laid out Ricardo with the code breaker. And then he and Dolph stared at each other until Ziggler laid Jericho out with the zigzag. Crowd didn't seem to like that very much. You would think this is all setting up a triple threat match for the world title and Money in the Bank, but you'd be wrong. They set up a singles match for the pay-per-view later on with Ryback and Jericho. So I'm not really sure what the hell the point of this was. Ryback versus Jericho, according to Jericho's own words, that's the match that was originally scheduled for WrestleMania before it got switched to Fandango. So we're going to end up getting the match how many months later? 5 months later? Something like that? John Cena doing his promo on this show. You would think John Cena doing a promo would not be listed into the good from the good, the bad, and the ugly. He didn't do comedy, so that's a plus. That kind of blew my mind. But here's the thing about John Cena. John Cena is doing this promo. He has this part where he says, "Allow me to introduce myself." As if we don't know who the fuck he is. He says, "My name is John Cena. I'm the WWE Champion." And then the director pans to a shot of the crowd. And I will give the crowd in North Charleston credit for this. Okay? I can't be too harsh on this crowd just because of this one moment. When the camera pans to the audience, and we see these guys holding up a long, giant sign that reads, "Cena has clap." And Kevin Dunn must have been freaking out in the truck, because as soon as they showed that sign, I mean, the sign was on TV for maybe 2 seconds. As soon as they showed it, the camera just jerked away, but it was too late. We all saw it. And it was great. I so badly wanted "Cena has clap" as a hashtag to start trending and see them put it in the little box in the corner of the screen. Now, that little box always pops up with the most meaningless shit. You know, Vicky Guerrero has a segment, then 5 minutes later during the next match, they'll put a little box in the corner that says, "Now trending, Vicky." What the fuck does that even mean? So the word Vicky is trending. I would rather see "Cena has clap" trending. And let them be honest and let them put that in the corner of the screen. At least that would be entertaining. The WWE Championship Money in the Bank match on July 14th will feature all babyfaces. They're doing all babyfaces for the Raw one, all heels for the SmackDown one. And the babyface contingent here will be made up of CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, Sheamus, Randy Orton, Christian, Kane, and the returning Rob Van Dam. It's odd that they're doing 7. I know in the past they've done 6, they've done 8 also sometimes. Now they're doing 7. So I don't think they're adding anybody, so that's going to be the final total. All of them are former World or WWE champions, interestingly enough. And you know what? Having Punk, Bryan, and RVD in the same match makes it all worth it. Plus, we get Christian and Randy Orton again. And I know there were people who were sick to death of that feud back in 2011, and I kind of got sick of it too, I admit. They had so many matches, to the point where it was just completely absurd. And the only reason I didn't rag on it too much at the time, because I hate that. You know, when they have a program and they just drive it into the ground month after month after month, it gets old. But I didn't mind it because Christian and Orton are so damn good together. Their chemistry is so great. They had great matches that I really didn't mind it. And now so much time has passed. Christian was out for like a year. He was hurt. I look forward to seeing the two of them. I'm going to be very upset if they don't have any interaction in this match on the pay-per-view. So you get no complaints out of me. Also on this show, you know, as time goes on, I find Vicky Guerrero increasingly annoying. But I have to say, that woman was a heat magnet on this show. For a crowd that was as dead as this one was throughout the 3 hours, you would not believe the reaction that she got. I have not seen her get heat like this in years. And again, this was in front of a crowd that was largely dead. So kudos to her. She didn't have to do much. She just did her usual shtick. But she was hated on this show. And lastly here with the good, the Diva stopwatch was a minute 22 for Caitlyn versus Oksana. And that's with the distraction and everything else. The match itself was nothing. Wasn't very good, but it was just an angle to further the storyline between Caitlyn and AJ. And I thought AJ was fantastic with her promo. She came out dressed up as Caitlyn in a muscle suit, and she had the highlights in her hair. And I thought she was really good here. I like the AJ stuff. And then there was the bad. This was a big night for Daniel Bryan. That's good. But they did him no favors with that promo to open the show. He came out, he talked for a little bit. This is when Orton came out. They started their match, it got broken up. It was a wild brawl, out of control. But Bryan had the mic. You know, you've got this guy out there drawing attention to the fact that he is smaller than everybody else, and that people look at him on the street and they can't believe he's a wrestler. This is what he said during the promo. "People look at me and they don't believe me when I say that I'm a pro wrestler. They look at him and think that he looks like a hobbit," he said. A hobbit. The same guy you're going to groom to wrestle John Cena for the WWE Championship. Whoever scripted this promo is an idiot and should have no further influence over Daniel Bryan's segments going forward. I just thought this was so stupid that you would use these words and blatantly draw attention to this kind of stuff. Why do you even have to bring this up? You know, if you're going to groom him for a pay-per-view main event, and I don't think him and Cena are going to main event SummerSlam. I'm pretty sure it's Punk versus Lesnar as the final match to close the show. So again, and you know, they'll call it the main event or the co-main event. I don't really think it's going to be the main event, but why would you say these things? Why would you have the guy out there calling himself a hobbit, saying people look at me and they don't think I'm a real wrestler? I also wouldn't have the announcers on commentary talking about Bray Wyatt tweeting. Did you pick up on that? They did it more than once, too, on the show. They showed the great Wyatt family promos, creepy stuff, out in the woods. And at the same time, they're saying, well, earlier today, Bray Wyatt was tweeting. Why would you do that? It kills the mystique a little bit. You know, we're seeing creepy videos of this guy in the woods, but let's see what tweet they sent out this morning. It just seems very odd to me that they would do that. CM Punk and Darren Young had a match, which died on the vine here on this show. It's fine for Punk to work with, you know, guys like Darren Young and try to make him look good, but they're not going to do shit with Darren Young, and the crowd knows it, because you could hear a pin drop during this match. You know, I could excuse that during, let's say, Del Rio versus Jericho, because the match was really good, but this just felt like two guys out there going through the motions. You know, Punk probably didn't even want to be there. I think his Blackhawks were winning the Stanley Cup right around the time this match was taking place. I can't say that I blame him. Punk won with the GTS. The primetime players ganged up on him after the match until Curtis Axel ran in to make the save at Paul Heyman's request. And that obviously did not sit well with Punk, nor did Heyman's later announcement that this week on Raw it will be CM Punk and Curtis Axel as a team against Titus O'Neil and Darren Young. Lastly, from the bad on this show, Ryback made his first appearance since Payback. And for two straight minutes, Ryback had his ass handed to him by the great Khali. And then out of nowhere, he hoisted the big guy up for the shell shock, marched around the ring with him, and dropped him down for the pin. Would have been more impressive had he not gotten his ass kicked for the whole match. I'm not really sure what that accomplishes, but they say it's not how you start, it's how you finish. But this match and this segment still were no good. The ugly on this show. Obviously, the crowd was pretty ugly throughout the entire night. Not literally. I'm sure there were a lot of, good-looking people somewhere in the crowd. I couldn't tell you who they were. But as a crowd, in terms of reaction, pretty ugly on Raw this past Monday. But the other thing here I want to mention, I was distressed, maybe is the right word, to read how poorly this show did in the ratings with the focus being on Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton. Raw this week did one of its lowest numbers of the year, and the Bryan vs. Orton main event only added about 100,000 new viewers, which is awful for the overrun. I mean, you're talking about an overrun that can add, in a typical week, I think anywhere from 500,000, that is, to more than a million viewers, and they picked up 100,000 for this main event. And part of that number is people who normally tune in anyway at the end of Raw because they're waiting for the next show to start. So that's part of that number as well. But Bryan and Orton also had a match on SmackDown the week before, and that show was the least watched SmackDown, non-holiday SmackDown, since they started on the Sci-Fi Network. So I don't know what to make of it, other than just growing pains. You know, it may just take time for people to warm to Daniel Bryan as a main event player. I remember when CM Punk first started getting the big push, and Punk was ratings poison. I mean, they would go out of their way to open the show with CM Punk while he was the WWE champion, and they would make sure that it was John Cena in the final segment every week on the show just so that they would pop a big number. You know, now these days, Punk draws pretty well for them, but it took time. It didn't happen overnight. Bryan's been a mid-card guy, a tag team comedy player for so long now, and they're not doing him any favors by continuing with this weak link storyline. You know, enough already with the weak link bullshit. You're grooming this guy to be the top babyface, or I shouldn't say the top babyface. They're grooming him to be a top babyface, it would seem. And, you know, as if calling him a hobbit and a goat face isn't enough, you've got him out there saying this weak link crap over and over to the point where the people get sick of it. you know, they're pushing him, which is good to see. And they give him this big win over one of their top guys by submission. But then they shoot themselves in the foot by making him out to be this annoying little troll. You know, like, you remember the old troll dolls with all the hair? He's kind of got the hair going. He just needs that little gem on his belly that you rub. That's what he is. People don't want to see that. They want to see him go out there, house of fire, kick the shit out of people, and make them tap. He took out the Shield all by himself. That's the guy that people want to see. They did a video game cover reveal on this show for the new WWE 2K14 video game. This will be their first game with under 2K Sports. And they did the big reveal for who would be on the cover, and it is The Rock. So cue all the hate for The Rock being on the cover of the game when he's never around, he's not an active wrestler, he's just a big-shot movie star, he's taking a spot away from CM Punk or Zack Ryder or JTG, blah, blah, blah. I think that about covers that. Did I miss anything? Did I miss any excuses in there? Oh, by the way, I read this week's Observer, and with the latest pay-per-view numbers for the Royal Rumble, where Rock headlined against Punk for the title, it's now up to 560,000 buys worldwide, which puts it just behind the 2008 Rumble at Madison Square Garden, which just so happens to be the most successful Rumble of the last 10 years. So I hope those same people keep that in mind when they continue making excuses for why Rock shouldn't be on the cover. So just wanted to point that out. So the current Money in the Bank lineup for the pay-per-view coming up in Philadelphia looks like this. We've got the WWE Champion John Cena defending against Mark Henry. Alberto Del Rio will put the World Heavyweight title on the line against Dolph Ziggler. We have the WWE Championship Money in the Bank ladder match with Punk, Bryan, Sheamus, Orton, Christian, Kane, and RVD. And the World Championship Money in the Bank ladder match, which will be consisting of all heels, Wade Barrett, Jack Swagger, Antonio Cesaro, Dean Ambrose, Fandango, Cody Rhodes, and Damian Sandow. Not sure about this all-heel strategy here. I think this match could steal the show. I think the SmackDown Money in the Bank could surprise a lot of people, but crowd reaction may suffer as a result. Although I could see Ambrose getting a lot of cheers, being that they're in Philadelphia and he's kind of the hot hand right now. Chris Jericho and Ryback will have a match, and The Shield will defend the tag team titles against the Usos. Wouldn't surprise me to see Caitlyn and AJ maybe thrown on there in another match for the Divas title, but they have not yet announced that. NXT, this week's episode, taped from Full Sail University. They can't all be winners. I thought it was a pretty boring show this week. Big E Langston, first appearance since losing the NXT title to Bo Dallas. He just steamrolled over Aiden English, pinned him with the big end. And then he delivered another big end, pinned him with the five count. Crowd chanted one more time, so he climbed back in the ring, delivered a third big end for yet another five count. So Langston, far more over on this show than he is on Monday Night Raw. Emma beat Oksana to advance in the women's title tournament. Emma has the best entrance in all of NXT. She is quite great. The match itself was not great, but Emma won with her dilemma submission finisher, which looks more devastating than John Cena's STF, which is not saying much, but that just feels wrong. That should not be the case when you have a diva in developmental whose finisher looks more punishing than your WWE champion. It's basically a reverse Indian deathlock into a chin lock, and she pulls back, and it's great. She'll meet Summer Rae in the next round. Leo Kruger made his big return, defeating Dante Dash in basically a squash match. Dante Dash, we were told, was a linebacker at Rutgers, and unfortunately for him, his football skills did not do much to help him here. Kruger won, also by submission, much like Emma. We seem to be seeing the rise of submission specialists in WWE right now. Don't know who's responsible for that, but I don't mind that. Kruger is from South Africa. He plays this role of hunter, and by that I don't mean like he's Triple H or anything like that. He plays this hunter-type character. He comes off a bit deranged. I don't know why. Maybe I'm the only one. But Leo Kruger reminds me of John Voight's character in the movie Anaconda. There's just something very unsettling about the guy. We got a video with Conor O'Brien claiming the Ascension will rise again. Thank God. They came to their senses and they're getting him a new tag team partner instead of using him as a singles. You know, as a singles, he's just another guy. What we need are more tag teams, so I think this is a good idea. No idea who his partner will be, he didn't say. The new NXT champion, Bo Dallas, came out next for a quick squash. This was the night of squashes here on NXT. He beat some guy named Mickey Keegan in about 90 seconds. Leo Kruger, who never left ringside after his match, he was crouched down on the floor outside the ring, just watching the entire time. Like I said, very unsettling. Dallas won with his belly-to-belly suplex finisher. You know, Christ, I mean, here I thought Langston had a horrible finisher. This guy is the NXT champion, and that's the move he uses to finish off his opponents. It's like when Shawn Michaels used to use that teardrop suplex back in the day when he first went solo. It was such a crappy move. And for a guy like Shawn Michaels, who wasn't very big, at a time when WWF had mostly big dudes, he was going to have to find another move anyway, because ain't no way he was picking up some of those guys with the teardrop suplex. Once he stopped using the super kick as a setup move and started using it as a finisher, he took off. So Bo needs a better looking move. Kruger came into the ring when it was over. He beat up Keegan, stared at Bo's belt, said ta-ta, and then left. Ta-ta. Now he's stealing Sting's gimmick. Main event was Corey Graves and Cassius Ohno beating Scott Dawson and Garrett Dillon to become number one contenders to the NXT Tag Team titles. Corey Graves made Dillon tap out for the submission. Another submission on this show. I think that's three. Ken Shamrock would be proud. He invented the tap out in WWE. Did you know that? Ken Shamrock invented the tap out? Before he came in, I don't remember there being anybody in the company who would make people tap out. There was no such thing as the tap out in WWE before Ken Shamrock came in. You just kind of, if you were in a submission hold, you just kind of shook your head up and down repeatedly and screamed yes, and the referee called for the bell. Shamrock came in, and all of a sudden people started tapping out left and right. A pioneer that man was. After the match, the Wyatt family ran down to attack the babyfaces. Adrian Neville, the former Pac, ran down to even out the odds, but Garrett and Dillon teamed up to beat him down. They were basically helping the Wyatts beat all of them down. And this brought William Regal down from the announce booth to help the babyfaces. He got beat down for his troubles, and they seemed to be teasing a possible match down the road between Bray Wyatt and William Regal, which I would be totally fine with. That's fine with me. That's something to look forward to. But just a standard show. I thought NXT was overall pretty boring this week. Let's talk TNA for a little bit here. TNA is hosting a base brawl event in Brooklyn, in my neck of the woods, this upcoming Friday, July 5th. This will be their fourth outdoor show here, and I have been to all four, and that includes the one coming up on Friday. So I elected to go to this show over Raw at the Barclays Center in 2 weeks. It's going to be the first ever Raw in Brooklyn, so this show better be good. I'll have a full report on next week's Sound Off, but here's the lineup. I just want to mention this because it's actually a pretty good lineup, although traditionally at these shows, the matches don't go very long, but Bully Ray and Kurt Angle for the TNA title, Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries in a Bound for Glory series match, James Storm and Gunner against Bad Influence for the tag team titles. Here's a match that I'm looking forward to, AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, and Bobby Roode in a three-way match. Joseph Park will take on D-Von of Aces and Eights, and I don't give a shit about Aces and Eights, but the fact that Joseph Park is going to be on this show sells me on the whole thing. Is it wrong that I may be more excited about Joe Park making an appearance than I am about the three-way with Styles, Roode, and Joe? I think I may have issues. Mickie James and Velvet Sky for the Knockouts title, and then they'll have Eric Young and Jesse Godders probably open the show. So, like I said, I'll have a full report next week. I'm gonna make it my goal to meet Joe Park and shake that man's hand and ask him if he has a business card for Park, Park, and Park in the event that I ever need legal counsel. Earlier this week, Taz posted a tweet that got people talking, and a tweet that he has since taken down. And that tweet said, "Couple of big wrestling shows in my hometown of Brooklyn, hashtag Red Hook near Barclay." And I didn't think anything of it at first because, again, I knew of the TNA show coming to Brooklyn. I didn't think Taz would be there, but he mentioned Barclay in the hashtag, which is where Raw is on July 15th at the Barclays Center, and that got people talking. And again, Taz has since taken the tweet down, and interestingly enough, he has not posted anything to refute the rumors, and the rumors are that his contract is expiring, if it hasn't already, sometime in the next 2 weeks. You know, they had Todd Kennelly working without a contract before they got rid of him, So that doesn't necessarily mean he's definitely off television. If you know, even if his deal did lapse without signing a new one, because again, they had this other guy on television without a contract for months. I have not read the spoilers. They had Impact tapings in Las Vegas this weekend because they don't want to air a live show on July 4th. So they taped Impact this weekend, but I believe Taz did do commentary at the tapings. So this could very well be his last appearance for them. I'm just trying to think of what the hell they would do with him if he did go back to WWE, which seems to be the belief. That if he leaves, he would end up back there. I know they just fired Matt Stryker, but they've already got Alex Riley replacing him on Superstars, I think it is. And, you know, even if they put Taz in that role, it would be a demotion for him. You know, I mean, why pay to bring this guy in and then put him on one of your C-level shows? The Raw announce team is pretty well set. I actually like the combination of Cole King and JBL. Largely because JBL brings some nice levity to the announce booth, and they have good chemistry. They all gel well together. I guess SmackDown would probably make sense. Right now on SmackDown, you've got Cole and JBL. They work great together, but you know they're already on Raw. So why not reunite Taz and Michael Cole on SmackDown? They had great chemistry together back in the day. For a while there, when SmackDown was the A show, we're talking like 2002, 2003... I remember thinking that Cole and Taz were the best announced duo in WWE. I felt like JR and King were kind of played out at that point, a little bit burned out on them, and Cole and Taz had overtaken them as the more entertaining, I think, of the two announced teams. And I remember reading also that, you know, Cole and Taz had some sort of falling out. I don't know when that happened. There was a point where Cole and Taz got broken up. And I think it was around that time, and I don't know what the fallout between them was. I think now they're cool. Like, you know, I don't know if they're friends, but they're amicable now. I never did find out what that falling out was or if that was just a rumor. But anyway, the point is they had good chemistry. I wouldn't mind seeing them back together. And who knows, it might light a fire under Taz's ass to have a change of scenery. I've said before that for a while now, Taz, as an announcer in TNA, just hasn't been doing it for me. It was like he's just there to collect a paycheck. He didn't sound motivated. He didn't sound like he wanted to be there. And it's funny I mentioned that because I thought Taz on Impact this week was as entertaining as he's maybe ever been in that company. I actually have praise for Taz on commentary this week. And that brings us to Impact, which was taped the week before from Peoria, Illinois. Impact was back in Peoria for the second week because Frank the Clown and Brock Lesnar Fan Guy were both in the crowd again, as they were last week. So that's how I knew. Brock Lesnar Fan Guy wears the same shirt wherever he goes. He is always wearing the same thing. So, but then again, so is Frank. I mean, he's a clown. Samoa Joe is the newest member of Sting's Main Event Mafia. Sting and Angle told us at the beginning of the show that all members must be former world champions, which makes me wonder if Jeff Hardy joins at some point. I believe at the Impact tapings this weekend, they did reveal a new member of the Main Event Mafia, I think. I did not bother reading who that was, so maybe it was Hardy. I don't know, but it would make sense. I would love to see Jeff Hardy in the Main Event Mafia, just to see him come out dressed in a suit without the face paint. I can't picture Jeff Hardy walking out there in a suit like a made man. Joe beat Ken Anderson in a Bound for Glory series match after the Aces and Eights guys came down to interfere. Sting and Angle came out to chase them away, so Joe got the win and the points. The other big news on Impact this past week was the reveal of Suicide. Chris Sabin, Kenny King, and Suicide had a three-way match for the X Division Championship, which Suicide won, so he is the new champion. And before the match, Aces and Eights grabbed Sabin in the hallway backstage, and Bully Ray tried to bully him into not cashing in his title for a shot at Bully's belt. That's the gimmick they started last year, heading into Destination X, which is no longer a pay-per-view. It'll be a live Impact special on July 18th. So Bully just absolutely buries Sabin, and he buries the X Division 6 feet under, which I was actually fine with because Bully is a heel. And, you know, if we're being honest here, they're really not doing anything with the X Division these days. You know, they have these three-way matches every week. They're not really prominently featured. It is what it is. But I figured that Sabin would either fight back and you know, or would get off a good one-liner on Bully when they let him go. Nope, they just let Sabin go, and he ran off with his tail tucked between his two bad knees. Hell of a baby face Chris Sabin turned out to be here. So they do the three-way match, Suicide wins the title, and Hulk Hogan walks out on stage with T.J. Perkins, who Hogan reveals to be the real man behind the Suicide mask. T.J. was jumped in the back earlier by a mystery attacker. Boy, you know, talk about an anticlimactic reveal. Has T.J. Perkins ever even wrestled in TNA as himself? I know he did in ROH, but nobody seemed to know who he was. Anyway, Hogan demanded the masked man reveal himself, and instead Suicide ran through the crowd and escaped. Nobody from security thought to block him or tackle him. They just let this mystery man run off with the title. Later in the show, Hogan came back out. He demanded that Suicide come out and reveal himself, or he would be stripped of the championship that he just won. Suicide came out. He was still refusing Hogan's request to unmask. This brought out Bully Ray, who also wanted to know who it was. And at this point, I'm thinking, oh, God. Tell me it's not Bischoff or Briscoe underneath the hood. They unmask, you know, they cash in the title shot, and then they forfeit to Bully Ray in some sort of elaborate aces and eights scheme. Instead, Suicide spoke, and they dubbed his voice so it sounded altered, like DDP as the Stalker. And when he took off the mask, it turned out to be Austin Aries, the man who gave up his X Division title last year to get a world title match against Bobby Roode, which he won. And he vowed to do the same thing again. This was actually a really clever angle, and at least for the next 3 weeks, between now and the 18th, it gets Austin Aries back in the title picture. I don't know if that means the end of his team with Bobby Roode. I really like them as a team, but at least they're doing something with Aries again. You know, it'll be interesting to see if they book him as a babyface over the next few weeks or not. I guess it really doesn't matter. The fans already cheer for him anyway. But I did not see this coming. I like this little twist here on this show. Our gut check contestants this week were two familiar faces with WWE ties, sort of. The Big O from Zack Ryder's Z True Hollywood Story and Ryan Howe. Ryan Howe was a contestant on the last season of Tough Enough with Steve Austin. These were the two men vying for a TNA contract. And while I'd like to think that it actually says the Big O on his birth certificate, his real name is actually Adam O'Reiner, which sounds far less cool. He's got some charisma based on, you know, what I have seen of him on YouTube in those clips from Zach's show. But for the most part, he's just the big jacked up dude who's not very good in the ring. You know, TNA already has one Rob Terry on the roster. I don't really think they need two. Ryan Howe is a guitarist, or at least that's the gimmick. He plays music. He came out. He played a version of the Star Spangled Banner on an electric guitar. That was probably more impressive than anything I saw either man do in the ring. And then Taz busted out the best line of the night that just made me legit laugh out loud when he said it.
He's back!
How's that? What do you mean he's back?
Van Hammer! I love this guy!
Van Hammer?
So hard, I laughed when he said that. He then said that he was Van Hammer after visiting an anti-aging clinic, which was another good line. He's not too far off. You know, personally, the way he was dressed, I actually thought that Ryan Howe looked more like Pirate Paul Burchill or Captain Jack Sparrow than a rock star. The match sucked. No way around it. It was not good at all. Neither guy came out of this looking like they deserve a contract. Maybe they give it to the Big O if they think he's got something and they want to send him down to OVW for a while. Can you imagine if the Big O ends up getting a contract and ends up on the actual Impact Wrestling roster with a push? Can you imagine what Zack Ryder would think? The dude would become suicidal. Mickey James retained her Knockouts title over Velvet Sky when she went after Velvet's bad knee. She used a submission for the tap out. Poor Velvet. Didn't Brooke Hogan say that she got medical clearance from Velvet's doctor that she was ready to compete? I mean, what kind of doctor did Velvet go to? A veterinarian? I mean, what kind of doctor is this? After the match, Christy Hemme saw Velvet in tears, so naturally, she shoved the microphone in her face and asked her how she felt. And through her fake crying, she said that she thought her knee was 100% and she was heartbroken. Some fans chanted, "You tapped out" at her. You know, after Mark Henry's performance on Raw a few weeks ago, Velvet's attempts here at shedding tears were quite poor. Actually, this whole thing came off to me like a ripoff of what WWE just did with Caitlyn and AJ. I mean, after AJ beat Caitlyn at Payback, the scene was almost identical. You had Caitlyn crying in the aisleway and the fans chanting, "You tapped out" at her. And, you know, by the way, when Mickey came out for her entrance, forgot to mention this. Taz was singing her theme song, the hardcore country song. And hearing a guy with a thick New York accent from the Red Hook section of Brooklyn singing hardcore country was quite comical. I'm telling you, Taz was in rare form on this show. Maybe he knew he was on his way out and he just said, fuck it, I'm going to go out there and have fun. I don't know. But he was very entertaining on this episode of Impact. Magnus pinned Bobby Roode in another Bound for Glory series match. Magnus looked good here, and Bobby Roode really helped him out, made him look good. Nothing wrong with this at all. James Storm and Gunner came out to the ring. Storm was cutting a promo when he was interrupted by Robbie E. and Jesse Godders, who had Tara back at his side. It's been a while since we've seen Tara on Impact. She wasn't even there when Brooke Hogan did her little State of the Knockout speech the week before. Robbie said that they were now a team, and they're calling themselves Bromans. Storm thought he said Bromance and got the crowd to chant Bromance at them. Jesse pointed out that Tara was his girlfriend, so of course he can't possibly be into other men. Because there's no way a guy who was into other guys would try to disguise that by being with a girl. That never happens. Storm referred to Tara as a butterface, and the crowd started chanting butterface at her, which is just terrible. Jesse went to go after Storm. Gunner dropped him with one punch, and that was that. And then came the Joe match with Anderson and the suicide reveal at the end. So, a good show. I enjoyed Impact this week, and if that was Taz's final show, and it doesn't look like it was, I think he was at the Vegas taping, so he may be back next week and maybe even the week after, but if this was his last show, as far as I'm concerned, he went out on a high note. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com, and if you would like to hear yourself potentially on the Sound Off, again, we are now accepting audio questions. I only got a few this week, and I'm only going to run one because the other two, one of them was not in the proper format, and I just, for whatever reason, couldn't get it to work, and the other one was very poor quality, so I'll probably end up reading it instead. So we're going to play an audio question here, but if you want yours to be played, you can record one, MP3 format only, keep them brief, give or take about 30 seconds or so, and please include your question in written form in the body of the email as well. This week's audio question comes to us from overseas.
Hello, Solomonster. This is Paul from Glasgow, Scotland. My question involves Drew McIntyre. I'm curious to know if you think he has what it takes to become a main event player in WWE.
My thanks to Paul for sending that question in. I think Drew McIntyre could have been a main eventer, absolutely. They were pushing him hard when he first came into WWE. Vince McMahon went on television and proclaimed him to be the next big thing or something to that effect. Now, he's been a prelim guy for so many years, I can't see him in the main event. I think that ship has sailed. At best, if they wanted to try pushing him again, he could be a solid upper mid-card guy, maybe. But I don't see how anybody could take this guy seriously as a top player after the way that he's been portrayed for the last few years. I just don't see it. And it's really a shame because I remember seeing a match on FCW television years ago when both guys were in developmental. It was him against Sheamus. They both came up together. I think Drew may have been the champion at the time. I think he was a babyface. And they had a great match. And you look where Sheamus is today on the totem pole in WWE, and there's no reason that Drew McIntyre couldn't be at that same level, but they ruined him. Brandon from Franklin, Kentucky writes in, on Sound Off 280, you mentioned how every time Xavier Woods said, "It's Morphin time" on NXT, it reminded you of Power Rangers. Being the huge Power Ranger fan that I am, I just wanted to point out that it appears they are incorporating Power Ranger elements into Xavier Woods' character. The watch that you alluded to and said made a beeping noise is actually the wrist communicator that first appeared in Mighty Morphin Power Rangers that alerted the Rangers whenever a monster was attacking. The ring announcer also billed Woods as being from Angel Grove, California, which is the fictional town that was the primary setting of the first six seasons of the TV show. That comes to us from Brandon, whose Power Ranger knowledge far exceeds mine. Steve from Indiana. He and his girlfriend Chrissy just celebrated their one-year anniversary on Friday, and he seems to be head over heels for this girl, so congrats to the two of them. It's been mentioned before that Dolph Ziggler should use the super kick as a finisher with him as a babyface. I think this would tie in well with the storyline of Alberto Del Rio's multiple kicks to Dolph's head to win the championship. If Dolph won the title back with a kick of his own, what do you think of this idea? I think it's a great idea, and I think it makes sense. Dolph does not have to abandon the zigzag as a finish. People seem to be into the move, but there's nothing wrong with expanding your moveset. You know, I used to praise Sheamus on this show all the time for that back when he had like four or five different go-to moves that he could bust out during his matches. I mean, these days he pretty much only uses the bro kick as a finish. I don't even think he does the Razor's Edge anymore. I don't know if they banned it or what happened. I know a lot of guys were landing pretty hard on the back of their heads, so maybe with all the fuss over concussions, they told him not to use it, but he used to have the Razor's Edge, the bro kick, White Noise, the Texas Cloverleaf. I think there may have been another move. I can't remember. He had a variety of ways that he could beat you, and I like that. I think more guys should have move sets like that. Antonio Cesaro kind of does, although he's not really being pushed. So I can't think of a better time for Dolph to start using the super kick than their match at Money in the Bank. I say let him use the zigzag and have people thinking the match is over, but Del Rio kicks out. And Dolph's all frustrated, doesn't know what to do. They could do a finish like the one Del Rio did with Randy Orton once. I can't remember if it was on Raw or at a pay-per-view. I think it was on Raw. But Del Rio does that Enziguri move in the corner where he runs in, kind of springboards himself off the ropes before kicking his opponent in the back of the head. I remember he and Orton did this finish where Del Rio bounced off the ropes, but Orton caught him with the RKO on his way down. Why not do a similar finish here? Only this time, as Del Rio comes off the ropes in the corner, Dolph catches him with a well-placed super kick on his way down. So it'd be sweet revenge for Dolph to win the title back with his own kick to Del Rio's head plays off the whole concussion angle. It's just an idea. Donnie from Savannah, Georgia writes in, "Hello, Solo Monster," or as Tim Arson would say, "Solo Monster." I like Tim. First interview I ever did on this podcast was with Tim Arson. Episode 129. On episode 127, Donnie says, "You said that TNA had the better roster talent-wise as compared to WWE. Some 150-plus episodes later, would you say the same thing today?" I would not, actually. I think WWE has overtaken them in the talent department, which is not to say that TNA doesn't have some of the best wrestlers out there, because they do. They've got Kurt Angle, which is a big a big feather in your cap, I think, to have on your roster. They've got Austin Aries, they've got Joe, Rude, Styles, Daniels, Kazarian. But since I recorded that show, WWE has done a much better job of focusing their efforts on developmental and bringing in some real talented guys instead of just green guys who look good but they can't wrestle. And, I mean, look at the active roster right now. Look at the pool of talent that they've got. They've got CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, both in top positions. They've got Randy Orton, Dolph Ziggler, Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, Kofi Kingston, Wade Barrett, Antonio Cesaro, and that doesn't even include the guys they have in NXT right now. You know, the Wyatt family, Corey Graves, Cassius Ohno, Adrian Neville, Sami Zayn. They've really beefed things up quite a bit. I want to say when I did that episode, it was probably, 2009 maybe? It was a long time ago. I would still give the edge to TNA in terms of the knockouts over the Divas, but even that seems to be changing. WWE still has a ways to go with the Divas. I mean, they still don't let them wrestle, which is kind of the whole point. But they've got some good women down in NXT right now. They've got Paige and Emma are really the two standouts. They've got Sasha Banks and Bayley, and I think Summer Rae's on the active roster now, and she's not very good. But even there, the tide may be turning a little bit, but I would still give the knockouts the advantage over the Divas, because at least the knockouts can actually wrestle. You know what I mean? Like, I'm looking forward to seeing the ladder match between Gail Kim and Taryn Terrell. I didn't read the spoilers. Hopefully they gave them some time and had a good match. I'm actually looking forward to seeing their match on Impact because of how great their last match was. But in terms of the active roster right now with the guys, I have to give the edge to WWE. Jackson from Washington, Illinois, the birthday boy, writes in, "My question for you, or really an idea I had, is about what WWE could do with Cody Rhodes right now. To me, he's an underrated performer who seems to always be stuck in creative limbo. And now that they're pushing Damian Sandow and jobbing Rhodes to Sheamus, I thought this would be as good a time as any to come up with a new storyline for him. My idea would be to bring in Goldust to team up with his brother. After seeing the reaction he got in the Royal Rumble, I think them teaming up could do a lot of good, especially after the success Goldust had teaming up with Booker T many years ago. With Team Hell No broken up, this also allows them to come in and be the comedy tag team and eventually challenge the Shield for the gold. This could all lead to Goldust getting inducted into the Hall of Fame, then spending the whole month leading up to WrestleMania bragging and turning heel, then have him put Cody over in a match at WrestleMania, the one that he keeps asking for. When brothers team up, it tends to lead to one of them becoming a big star like Jeff Hardy, Bully Ray, or Edge, and it also adds more depth to the tag team division. I even have the name picked out for them, Gold Stash. And Cody can paint his mustache gold, and then you can sell those as well. Are you a fan of this idea, and do you think it could work? I don't really see what good it does. Gold Stash, really? Anyway, I don't really see what good it does for Cody to be constantly bouncing around from tag team to tag team. I mean, when he first came in, he tagged with Bob Holly. Then he went heel, and he was tagging with Ted DiBiase as part of Legacy. And now he's been doing the Road Scholars thing with Damian Sandow. The best thing he ever did, in my opinion, as a single, he brought back the classic Intercontinental belt. I'm a mark for that belt. I love it. To me, though, if that's his biggest claim to fame, that's pretty sad. And he's been around now for a whole bunch of years. Now, as far as the mustache thing is concerned, the mustache thing is played out. I mean, painting it different colors is only going to turn him into more of a cartoon character. Plus, he says his girlfriend hates the mustache, and he's got a hot girlfriend, so I would hate to see their relationship sour because of some hair on this guy's upper lip. I say let him lose it in a match on TV, you know, shave that shit off, and let's try to actually do something with Cody Rhodes for a change. You know, he's in the world title Money in the Bank match at the next pay-per-view. I'm not ready to make any predictions yet for the show. We'll do those for the Sound Off with Noah in 2 weeks, but I would make a strong case for Cody going over in that match and getting the upset victory. I don't think too many people would see it coming. You know, Damian Sandow's the one of the two of them who's been getting the push of late. You've got guys like Wade Barrett and Antonio Cesaro in that match, both of whom absolutely deserve to win, and I could see each of them with the briefcase. You've got Dean Ambrose in there, who many people agree is probably a future world champion. But to me, as long as he's got the U.S. title, I don't see him winning the briefcase. But you're going to have a lot of people who think Dean Ambrose may win. So why not give the win to Cody? Give him the surprise win. I mean, you remember when Daniel Bryan won the SmackDown Money in the Bank match? It came out of left field. Nobody was expecting it. He was losing a lot of his matches, but it helped propel him to the world title a few months later, which led to the 18-second loss at WrestleMania, which led to the crowd chanting yes on Raw the next night. I was there. And the rest is history. I'd rather see Cody carrying around a briefcase than teaming with his 40-year-old brother doing more comedy stuff. I don't think I would have minded it so much a year or two ago. There was a time when I thought maybe it would be good to bring Goldust in and do something. Not a tag team necessarily, but build up a match. But how much more time are you going to waste before you start doing something meaningful with Cody Rhodes? You want to wait until the guy is his brother's age now? And lastly here, Jonah from Kentucky, another Kentucky listener. WWE has put a lot of work into these great Wyatt family promos and a lot of thought into their presentation, but I've been trying to rack my brain to figure out who they'll work with or who I would like to see them work with. It doesn't seem like there's a place for them right now, at least not on top. You've got John Cena and Mark Henry, with Daniel Bryan waiting in the wings, and Bryan and Orton in the meantime, Sheamus and Sandow, Shield and Usos, Punk and Lesnar, Ziggler and Del Rio, Ryback and Jericho, so where do they fit? I don't expect everyone to get the new Shield push, but I also don't want to see this hot new trio come in and start feuding with the likes of Miz or Santino or Khali. I don't see them with the Shield right now, mainly because they're heels, although I guess it's possible the Wyatt family could somehow debut as faces. I hope not. I think that would be a terrible idea, but anyway, Jonah says, I'm just confused as to what to want or expect out of them. Are you confident that WWE has something planned for them when they arrive? Yeah, I'm confident because, you know, you've got this new edict from Triple H, which is that you don't bring guys up unless you've got something planned for them in advance. And it's obvious. I mean, you watch television here. They obviously had a plan for the Shield. They were in the main event from day one. Now it's almost a situation where the Shield is kind of settling into the mid-card, but they had a plan for them. I mean, hell, the Shield debuted in the main event of Survivor Series. And as far as the Wyatt family is concerned, I would imagine they're going to be debuting on television very soon. I mean, for all I know, it could be in the next week or two. I could see them making an impact at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. You know, why not have the Wyatts interfere in one of the Money in the Bank ladder matches, probably the WWE title one with the baby faces, and have them target somebody there? That'll be their first program. You know, or maybe they just go after Jericho, and they cost him his match against Ryback, put Jericho out of action the next night. Jericho is probably leaving again soon, anyway. I don't even think he's scheduled to wrestle at SummerSlam. So that's their entry point. That gives them a reason. That gives them something to do when they first come in. And there's nothing wrong with them after that. Let's say they take out Jericho. It's just an idea. But let's say after that, there's nothing wrong with having them in matches against guys at the level of Miz or Christian, and then working their way up from there. Whatever they do with them, I'm sure they've not invested all of this time and effort in hyping them up only to do nothing. So they're very high on Bray Wyatt, I hear. Even wrestlers, you know, in interviews and stuff. I think even Big Show, when he did that interview with Peter Rosenberg, who has an awesome interview up with Bully Ray this week, if you didn't see it, it's about 45 minutes long. But I've heard Big Show and other wrestlers, when they talk about the younger guys in NXT and stuff, they single out Bray Wyatt as somebody they'd like to work with. So there's a lot of hype surrounding this guy. I doubt they're going to bring him in and drop the ball. I'm pretty confident they've got something up their sleeve, and I'm anxious to see what that is. You know, Luke Harper and Eric Rowan, it's good that we've got another tag team coming in. God knows we need more of those. Shield of the Champions right now, if these guys come in as heels, I can't see them against each other right away. Could they build to a Shield Wyatt family program? Yeah, it's possible. Although, again, I don't know that heel versus heel makes sense, but I would much rather see the Wyatts come in as heels because they're so good in their role on NXT, creepy as they are. I just think as babyfaces, it would just die a death. Seems to happen a lot. I talked about Doink earlier. Doink was great as the evil clown. You turn him babyface, it just turns him to mush. So hopefully they come up as heels, and if they're going to be on television in the next few weeks, I would save them for Money in the Bank. Have them interfere in a match. The Jericho match, one of the ladder matches. Cost somebody the match, knock them off the ladder, do something. Pick a target, go after that target, and you've got a reason for them to be there now. Once they're on television, they've got a purpose. They're not just there floundering with nothing to do.
History has been made here!
We have a new feature we're debuting this week. This Week in Wrestling History. And I picked a hell of a week because there's a lot of shit that happened this week in wrestling history. I don't think this segment's going to be quite as packed as this week is. So just FYI, not everyone will be as long, but there's a lot of stuff that occurred on this past week over the years in wrestling history. We go back 15 years ago this week, back on June 28th, 1998. WWE held its King of the Ring pay-per-view, which saw one of the most famous matches in the history of the business, the Hell in a Cell match between Mankind and The Undertaker. It's one of those matches where I remember exactly where I was and who I was watching the show with when it happened, because all of our reactions were exactly the same when Foley took that first bump off the cage. It was just this universal, holy shit, what the hell did I just see reaction that I don't think I've had for a match probably since, and hopefully never will, if that means other people will be spared from flying 16 feet off the top of a cage. Here's a more obscure reference for you. 13 years ago this week, on June 26, 2000, Lance Storm had his debut match in WCW. He beat Disco Inferno. Storm would become the only man in WCW history to hold three titles at once, the U.S., Cruiserweight, and Hardcore Championship. And 3 years later, WWE saddled him with a gimmick where the fans chanted boring at him, and he started dancing on TV. A year later, he was gone. It's funny how that works. He currently runs his own school, the Storm Wrestling Academy, up in Calgary, and some familiar faces on NXT like Sylvester Lefort and Emma trained there before being signed by WWE. 11 years ago, this past Monday, June 24, 2002, Bret Hart suffered a stroke while riding his bike without a helmet. He hit a pothole. He was thrown from the bike, landed right on his head. And it was a phone call while in the hospital from Vince McMahon that helped ease the tension between the two sides to where they were at least cordial with one another, and then many years later, helped make it possible for Bret Hart to come back to WWE. And had Bill Goldberg not mule kicked Brett into oblivion at Starrcade, which gave Brett a concussion, and then other concussions followed before he was aware of what was going on that led to his retirement. If that had never happened, who knows if Brett would have even suffered that stroke 4 years later. And if he doesn't suffer the stroke, I think we would have gotten some pretty kick-ass matches later in Bret Hart's career, but it was not to be. It's great to see Brett as active as he is today because, you know, he easily could have ended up a vegetable for the rest of his life or worse. Brett tweeted this week, "They came to get me that day, but I had something better to do. Live." Also 11 years ago, only 3 days after Brett's stroke, it was June 27th, 2002, some guy named John Cena made his debut on WWE television on SmackDown, answering the challenge of Kurt Angle. Had a good back-and-forth match, and in the end, Cena lost. And in doing so, he earned the respect of some of the other babyface wrestlers who congratulated him backstage for hanging in there with the Olympic gold medalist. And that's when The Undertaker appeared. He asked John Cena what his name was, and then Undertaker shook his hand and told him he'd done good. And this was at a time when Undertaker was a heel. So here we are 11 years later, and these two men could very well be on a collision course for next year's WrestleMania. 6 years ago, this past week, Chris Benoit murdered his wife and 7-year-old son, then took his own life in easily the worst tragedy in wrestling history. Some people will choose to remember Benoit because he was a great wrestler, but let's not also forget the two other people who lost their lives who were not given a choice. Here's a little trivia note for you. Nancy Benoit, the former woman, was working as a model and a receptionist when George Napolitano, who I interviewed on Sound Off 182 and consider a friend, he needed an attractive woman for the cover of his Wrestling All-Stars magazine, and somebody had recommended Nancy for the cover. And I guess she had been to some wrestling shows before with her then-husband, so some people knew her. And it was at that photo shoot where Nancy met Kevin Sullivan for the first time, and a month later she was making her debut as part of his act. And then later she divorced her husband, married Kevin Sullivan, and then they later divorced, and that's how she ended up with Chris Benoit. And finally, it was 2 years ago this week, on June 27th, 2011, that CM Punk dropped that epic pipe bomb on Monday Night Raw, cementing himself forever as a main event player in WWE. He had been toiling around in the mid-card after having a run as world champion a few times. He did the Straight Edge Society stuff. I know he was very upset when they got rid of Serena, they got rid of Luke Gallows and all that. But he was burned out. They weren't really doing anything with him. He was ready to walk away when he sat down Indian style on stage. He cut a work shoot promo on John Cena, on The Rock, John Laurinaitis, the entire McMahon family. He even gave a shout-out to his buddy Colt Cabana, talked about winning the title and maybe taking it back with him to Ring of Honor. It's too bad for ROH that never happened. They could use his help right now. The real significance of this promo, though, to me, is that it opened a lot of eyes in that company to what Punk and other indie guys like Daniel Bryan and Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose are really capable of. Guys who, in some cases, maybe are on the smaller side. They may not look the way a traditional WWE main eventer is supposed to look, but he opened a lot of eyes, I think, in that respect. And on Sound Off 228, I listed this promo as the number 5 top moment in Raw history, and it happened 2 years ago this week. Please keep sending in your questions to thesolemonster@gmail.com, including any audio questions that you may want to here, potentially on this show. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster, and you can send a Facebook friend request to facebook.com/thesolomonster. And also, don't forget, you can read my columns on the Layfield Report, layfieldreport.com. They are listed, if you look, by author name, so it is a little bit easier now to find any new columns that go up. There should be a new one, actually, that goes up this weekend. I just haven't worked on it yet. So please check out and support my work on layfieldreport.com as well. We'll be back here next weekend, episode 282 of The Sound Off. I'll have some thoughts on my live TNA experience in Brooklyn this Friday, weather permitting. You know, that's the thing you have to worry about with these outdoor shows. And we've gotten like 10 feet of water, I think, here in New York this month. One of the wettest Junes on record. It rains every freaking day. It's raining right now as I record this show. So I've got my fingers crossed that there will be a a positive turn in the weather later this week. We'll talk about that and everything else that goes on. For those of you that are going to be out celebrating for the 4th of July, enjoy the holiday. Hopefully you're off from work for more than just Thursday. And be safe. I say that every year. I have somebody who lives downstairs who actually works as an emergency room nurse, and some of the horror stories that she loves telling every single year are about July 4th in the ER and all of the fireworks accidents that she sees, blown off fingers and limbs, and it's pretty gruesome stuff. So whatever you're doing this 4th of July, just be safe, be smart, and until next time, we'll see you right back here for more of the Sound Off on Stitcher Radio and SEScoops.com.
You've been listening to the Salamonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Daniel Bryan's been unstoppable!
The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello! Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? The fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
Salamonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on SEScoops.com, TheSalamonster.com, and Stitcher Radio, The Salamonster Sounds Off.